It's the Confluence where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. The NHL is gearing up for a restart of its 2019-2020 season this week after pausing mid-March amid the coronavirus pandemic. League Commissioner Gary Bettman says fans can look forward to a 24-team playoff, but only on television. At least to start, no fans will be allowed in the arenas. Joining us with the context is Rob Rossi. He covers local hockey for The Athletic, so he's been stuck at home like the rest of us these last several weeks. So, Rob, what do we know about this new playoff system? What's the format?
Well, yeah, that's a great question, because what we know is that there's going to be a 24-team league, essentially, when the NHL returns, and the playoffs will still consist of 16 teams, the caveat being there are going to be play-in games and there'll be best of five series, and the Penguins will be in them. And what will happen is 12 teams from each conference will return to play. The other teams will just be beginning their off season. And then the top teams will get a bye and play a round robin tournament for seeding for what would be the first round of the playoffs. And based off that seeding, they will play the winners of the best of five play-in round.
So when does this play-in round start for the Penguins?
Well, that's the million-dollar question. And, you know, we didn't get dates or cities from Gary Bettman in his press conference. I've been told that everybody's hopeful that things could pick up in terms of, at the very least, training camps opening sometime in early to mid-July. The caveat being, if the cities they end up picking don't end up having spikes or a second wave, so to speak, in the coronavirus.
So why even finish this season? Why not just bag the whole thing and start fresh on the 2020-21 season?
Well, there are some real, Kevin, factors there that require them to try finishing this season. One, if they don't try finishing this season in some way, some of the local television contracts, not the Penguins, but some teams, if they don't play sort of a certain amount of games yet, they wouldn't get paid for next year from their television partners, just the way the contracts are wording. Two, the revenue that the league would lose from not holding a Stanley Cup playoff, even one that wouldn't have fans in the buildings, that would be more revenue lost, which would impact the overall revenue for the 2019-20 season. And the salary cap is tied directly to that. So if you're a player, you don't want your salary cut. If you're a free agent, or you're a restricted free agent, you don't want less money to be available than is already going to be available for your next contract. And if you're teams, you don't want to lose the money that you can make when you've gone at least 3 months now without any revenue. And unlike the other sports, Kevin, the NHL is, most of its money comes from gate revenue. So any money they can make up for losing the gate revenue from the Stanley Cup playoffs, in addition to the final, for some teams, six home regular season games, that would be significant.
Rob Rossi covers the Pittsburgh Penguins for the online sports site, The Athletic. Rob, thanks as always.
Thank you, Kevin. Take care. Stay safe.
It's the Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Healthcare professionals have been attempting to predict health outcomes for decades using family history, existing risk factors, and genetic information as it became available. But what if we started sooner, before we were even born? That question is at the heart of a perspective piece co-written this spring by Dr. Yoel Sadovsky, director of the McGee Women's Research Institute. He spoke recently to my Confluence colleague, Megan Harris.
Your piece for Science Translational Medicine argues that pregnancy is a great test case for using big data to analyze disease markers. Break that down for us. What can that gestational period tell us about disease?
The period of pregnancy, the 9 months of pregnancy, is truly unique from the point of view of convergence of data from maternal exposures, influences, fetal growth, environmental exposures. It's a very special time where convergence of those influences can truly shape disease risk, health, and hopefully lifelong wellness.
What kinds of data do you advise collecting? What's the most important?
The most interesting thing about the pregnancy is that it's one of the times that we have access to a lot of information, both from the mother's, usually pregnant women tend to be engaged in their care. They tend to come regularly for visits with the doctors. And also, at the time of delivery, we have access to a lot of hopefully normal tissue that can be used for truly understanding the trajectory of health and wellness. So we can collect blood and urine during routine clinic visits when they're done for other clinical care purposes. We can collect remaining of samples such as amniocentesis. Of course, at the time of delivery, the placenta commonly gets discarded. Not at our place. We save the placenta, membranes, umbilical cord, and we can use them to study what might have gone wrong and hopefully everything went right, and what can be used to truly project a trajectory of health and wellness across the lifespan.
You've been studying this concept of how the fetus grows and matures for much of your career. What is it about the concept of your research called deep phenotyping that could be such a game changer for clinicians in the future?
Two things. One is we can integrate these different types of data to try to define what we call a phenotype, a set of characteristics that hopefully can define health and wellness and hopefully can even identify risk of a disease or a deviation that can be actionable and corrected. For example, if we identify a blood test that may indicate that this pregnancy is at risk because of some environmental exposure, for example, lead, can we actually offer this specific mother a corrective or avoidance of the exposure in order to try to ensure healthy pregnancy? What's really important here is that once we integrate large amount of subjective data that mothers can tell us about their stress, about their behavior, about their potential exposures, we can integrate these data with electronic health records and with the analysis of the specimens that I just outlined to you, and also potentially couple it with environmental exposures such as type of water and air pollution and particles. We can really try to build a phenotype that not only affects the 9 months of pregnancy, but because of what we know about pregnancy and because pregnancy is really a prelude to a lifespan of health, hopefully, and potentially also diseases, we can really try to integrate these different types of data to try to build a phenotype. Now, when you say how we take advantage of the big data, we're really at the convergence, the confluence of two very important, I would say almost scientific revolutions. One of them is what people like to call big data. And the other one is really the innovation, the revolution of technology. And our idea is if we can integrate patient's subjective information and feelings along with healthcare, along with biotechnology and quote unquote big data, can we actually build a phenotype that can not only indicate to us the health of the current pregnancy, but also what is the trajectory for the mother and for the infant who is going to be the product of this pregnancy?
Is the power then in just the scope of the amount of information that you're able to gather in mass? Because it sounds like on an individual level, maybe the blood test example with lead, that might be something that could already happen, that exists now.
I think the power is in three major factors. One is the fact that we're really interrogating a period of health that is not only the beginning of life, but really has significance for the rest of our lives, both for the mother and for the fetus. The second one is the level of engagement. That's really a unique time, as I said before, a unique time when patients come to care. They really care about their own health and the health of their future baby, and are willing to truly invest in their long-term health. And the third one is the access to data. When you put all of these three together, I think it becomes a unique opportunity to use what we'd like to call a scientific wellness approach, which integrates an approach to medicine that is predictive, that is participatory, includes many people, that is personalized, and hopefully can really be used to project health wellness. And if there is a disease risk, hopefully rectify it.
Dr. Sadowski, thanks so much for your work.
Thanks for having me.
That was Dr. Yoel Sadowski, director of the McGee Women's Research Institute, speaking to The Confluence's Megan Harris. It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Pennsylvania primary elections were moved to June 2nd because of COVID-19. But 90.5 WESA's Ariel Worthy reports that while many other things have changed this election season, voters will have a familiar choice in the 19th State House District, where a longtime incumbent faces a repeat challenger.
District 19 is about half African American and includes some of Pittsburgh's largest communities of color. Many of the neighborhoods inside it suffer from poverty and a lack of access to resources other areas take for granted, like grocery stores. Incumbent Jake Wheatley says that since he was first elected in 2002, he has fought for social justice in his community, whether that meant support for marijuana legalization or seeking better access to fresh food.
When we fight about criminal justice and social justice reform, that's a fight for everyone, but primarily it's really a fight around improving the life condition of Black and brown people in Pittsburgh, because the criminal justice system throughout the state focuses heavily on the disparity around Black and brown.
District 19's neighborhoods include the Hill District, downtown Pittsburgh, parts of Oakland, some southern city neighborhoods, and Manchester. It's not always easy to solve problems in those areas. The Hill, for example, lacked a grocery store for decades. And while Wheatley says he helped get funding to lure a Shop and Save there in 2013, the store closed after 5 years.
We were the second community to receive a grocery store support from the Fresh Foods Initiative, which was a state policy that was meant to locate grocery stores in food deserts. We gave them $1.5 million. Now, again, I tell people, it's not our job to run the store, but it was our job to connect the resources to the store.
Wheatley's Democratic challenger says the grocery's fate proves that Wheatley isn't doing enough for the district. Arian Abney is a social worker who lives in Manchester. He says when he campaigns, he hears complaints from residents about the area's decline.
Right, been in office for 17 years, and people feel like their quality of life has not improved. And for many people, they feel like their quality of life has gone down. When we talk to people who live in the Hill District, they no longer have a grocery store, right? They only had a grocery store for a couple of years, and now they have a lack of access to fresh foods and groceries.
Abney also faults Wheatley for missing what he says are key votes in Harrisburg.
He has a lot of missed votes in Harrisburg, right? These are our tax dollars paying his salary, and the expectation is that he's going to work for us, and he's actually not showing up, and he's missing votes. And these are key votes around like corporate tax reform, tax relief for senior citizens, local gun safety laws, public school contracts, landlord-tenant issues.
Wheatley says though he has missed votes before, it was usually because of a scheduling conflict or personal emergencies.
Is my record perfect? No, but let's take it in context. Over 18 years, I voted on 72,000 or more votes.
When it comes to education, both candidates agree that there should be more oversight for charter schools. Abney says he would create a fair funding formula based on needs for school districts across the state. Wheatley has been one of the region's most vocal supporters of charters, but he says he supports a move by Governor Tom Wolf to require more transparency and accountability for charter schools. This is Abney's third time running against Wheatley. He withdrew before the primary in 2016. And in 2018, Wheatley won the election with just over 48% of the votes. Abney received 41% of them, and the remaining voters supported a third candidate. But Abney says voters don't have confidence in Wheatley. Wheatley, meanwhile, says he is confident that he will be reelected.
I think I've been a true champion for folk, and I think my experience will continue to produce for the 19th district.
Voters will decide who is right next week. I'm Ariel Worthy, 90.5 WESA News.
It's the Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. No one knows how many college campuses will be open this fall or how many students will show up. That uncertainty has huge financial implications for universities and their staff. Keystone Crossroads reporter Avi Wolfman-Arendt has this profile of the so-called academic gig workers who are stuck in limbo.
You think college professor, you're probably thinking well-paid, financially secure, tenured. You probably don't think of Wendy Marshall. She lives off federal disability and the roughly $9,000 she makes every year as an adjunct humanities professor at Temple University.
I would be plunged deeply below the poverty level without my adjunct pittance.
And you probably don't think of Patrick Coughlin, a fine arts instructor at a pair of Philadelphia colleges. He's trying to figure out how he'll pay his mortgage.
I have no idea what my income will be 3 months from now.
32-year-old Carla Anderson is also feeling pinched. The part-time English professor and PhD student just moved back to her mom's house in the Philadelphia suburbs.
Yes, I'm in my childhood bedroom. Whatever.
All three are adjunct professors. Adjuncts are often described as the gig workers of academia. They sign new contracts for each class they teach, typically making around $3,000 or $4,000 a course. Longtime adjunct and union activist Anna Neighbor says there's never guarantee of future work.
That has been our possibility at the end of every semester before this pandemic.
If enrollment plunges in the fall, universities will need to cut costs and probably cut classes. Adjuncts can be cut the easiest and at the last second.
We're incredibly disposable. You know, I think many of us are feeling quite stranded right now.
And there are a lot of them. At Pennsylvania universities with 5,000 or more undergraduates, non-tenured faculty make up over half of the teaching force, according to federal data. Many of those instructors will spend the next few months waiting on the fate of their classes.
No one knows. No one knows. And because this is so contingent on enrollment and funding, you know, there's so much uncertainty.
This is a nervous summer for higher education. Surveys show as many as a third of students may not attend in the fall if they can't go to classes in person. Dan Greenstein is chancellor of the Pennsylvania State System of Higher Education and says a big enrollment drop at the 14 schools he oversees would be
potentially existentially catastrophic.
Due to population declines and rising costs, Pennsylvania's state schools were already facing grim futures.
Our business model was unsustainable before the pandemic. Things didn't just get better.
Greenstein says he isn't a fan of using adjunct labor.
Conditions in that marketplace, as you know, can be pretty exploitative.
The state system has relatively few adjuncts and pays them relatively well. But right now, that presents a problem for the system financially because it means
there is less maneuverability in dealing with financial exigency that we're experiencing than other institutions would have.
Now, all sorts of college employees could lose work, from the classroom to the mailroom. But adjuncts are a useful bellwether for this moment in higher ed. They'll likely be the first to lose jobs if and when enrollment drops. And in a time when many predict financial pain for academia, adjuncts represent a kind of uncertainty and scarcity that seems fitting.
It's a little bit sad and bitter. But I have to say, the life of an adjunct has been sad and bitter all these years.
Debbie Lemure is 64. She's been an adjunct professor at Temple University for about a decade, and she tutors on the side. She usually teaches two courses a semester, but she's worried that work will dry up.
If I lose it, I am going to be eating into my retirement money.
She had hoped to retire in about 5 years. If she can no longer teach,
it means that that money is going to run out a whole lot sooner than I am going to die.
Lemure says she's ready to teach, but her fate is now tied to a simple question. How many students will actually raise their hands to attend? Avi Wolfman-Arendt, Keystone Crossroads.
And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. Thanks to our team, Helen Wicker, Tom Hurley, Julia Zenkovich, Doug Shugerts, and Megan Harris. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good day of good news.